Welcome to the continuing discussion of the nuclear disarmament issue. Tonight, under the rubric of nuclear arms, issue of faith, and then public policy. The kickoff team for this evening's discussion will be Dan Erlander from the Holden staff and Larry Rasmussen, also from the summer staff, the program director here. And I'm going to pitch the ball in Dan's direction first to address the issue of nuclear disarmament as a matter of faith. And then after his introduction, we'll pass the ball in the other direction, let Larry address some words to the matter of moving from faith to public policy. And then it will be yours. I'm really talked out, so I will function with my fingers to try to keep track and make sure everybody gets a chance to talk. If there are people behind the black cone, the cone of silence, I can't see you, so whistle or scream or holler to get my attention, okay? Dan, it's yours.
Okay. The way I'd start, I guess, about a year and a half ago, I worked here at Holden and got together a booklet called By Faith Alone, a Lutheran to the Bomb. Just fast advertisement. But part of preparing this book, somehow it also brought invitations to me to go out and speak on the nuclear arms race, which was very different for me because I've never really been out. My mother told me you're into a controversial area. When I go out, on a recent speaking trip, I was in Nebraska, and one pastor was quite disturbed that I was out talking about this because he said, do you realize that what this is a very highly technical, complicated issue of military and international politics? You know, and really basically was saying, what do you know about it as a, quote, simple pastor? And sometimes our responses are good, sometimes they're out. This, I don't think my response was too bad. I said I was really called to preach the gospel. I'm really not out talking about the arms race. I'm not preaching the gospel. This is just an interesting forum in which to preach the gospel. And I really mean it in this context. I think what clarified it for me was a year ago, Lee Griffin, who some of you might know, was here at the Village, and during a class I was teaching, he made this comment. He said, we preach a radical gospel against the background of a pastive evil. And I think what he meant is the gospel is liberation, and we preach that. But along with preaching that, how can I preach that gospel without naming the slavery or naming the bondage from which the joyous gospel would free us? And from that, in moving into the whole issue of militarism, and especially the nuclear arms race, I would begin, I think, this way that helps me understand. We say Hitler lost the Second World War, but in a way Hitler won. Because Hitler's doctrine that brute force is a way to live in this world. Violence and the threat of violence is the way to live in this world. Has been, I think, adopted by the world as a creed. And we know this, at least it speaks to me, the fact that the world spends $600 billion a year on arms. We know what our country spends, alongside in a world where a billion people are poor, half a billion are malnourished. When their anger comes forward, we have one response, it seems to me, and that's arms and more arms and more arms. And when the more I move into this and what is happening, I can't speak of it without using biblical terminology of the demonic and idolatry. I think the out of control nature of this and how the false doctrine that to me it has to be named what it is, and that's idolatry and demonic powers. And it is that false worship then that is the bondage that I think the freeing word of the gospel of Jesus Christ speaks. And simply what we talk about here is liberation. The liberation of ourselves, myself, the liberation of the church, and finally the liberation of the world, which is the wonderful message of the gospel from this idolatry. So it's really in that context that I have come to go out and speak about an issue when it gets into the technology of it. I'm pretty dumb. But I think there's no other way to speak about it except in some of these biblical concepts. So that's all I want to say, and we can respond to it later.
Yeah, thank you.
Larry? I'd like to supplement Dan's personal statement with a report of sorts that addresses the question of faith, public policy, and the nuclear arms. Many of you have followed with some interest the pastoral letter of the Roman Catholic bishops on war and peace, and it is, in my judgment, a kind of model for relating matters of faith, which they see as at the heart of the nuclear arms debate, to matters of public policy. That went through three drafts, the pastoral letter, and now has been approved by the American bishops as the American Roman Catholic churches stand on the issues. And you perhaps saw what was the most the item which received most attention, namely the tension between the Reagan administration's arms policies and the position of the bishops, in which they declared that they were in basic disagreement with the Reagan administration. I should say that that was after lengthy consultation with the Reagan administration. The Roman Catholic bishops proceeded in this whole matter by using a kind of hearings procedure in which they heard the testimony of a wide range of policy makers on nuclear arms issues, including Caspar Weinberger and others from the Reagan administration and members of past administrations. In other words, they focused their own work on the policy issues. Now, how does that relate to Christian faith? I am going to take just a couple of minutes to speak about the first two sections of the pastoral. The first section is a lengthy theology of peace and the affirmation of peacemaking as the Christian's vocation. Out of this biblical and theological work done by the bishops, they say that faith relates to the world and for Christians and to Christian morality in a couple of different ways. If one emphasizes one of the strong biblical themes that we have responsibility to care for all of creation, then the attention when it comes to public policy is attention drawn to how do you make common cause with for all folks of goodwill, whatever their religious or ideological persuasion. How do you work for the common good? Because as Christians, you are responsible for the care of the entire created order. If you, however, take your point of view and take your ethic from the radical character of the new creation as exemplified in Jesus of Nazareth, you are called to a more rigorous ethic. The ethic of following Jesus, which they see as a way of nonviolence and as the way of the cross. So the bishops conclude out of the first portion of the Theology of Peace that there are two options open to Christians in addressing nuclear arms. And the two options are the pacifist and nonviolent witness, and they say the Roman Catholic Church must acknowledge that, and we affirm our brothers and sisters in the faith who take that stand. We must take it very seriously, and I'm going to give reasons for that. They also say that it is a matter of faithfulness if Christians will follow in the tradition which seeks to set out moral criteria that all people of goodwill and common sense can agree to, whatever their own faith perspectives. That is what is called the just war tradition. And there are a set of criteria in the just war tradition which then become common grounds for developing public policy with non-Christians. And if we want to, we can talk about those, usually it's 7 or 8 criteria of the just war tradition. The point that got such attention is that and then the bishops proceeded to argue the case for relating faith to public policy on the basis of the just war tradition, not the pacifist tradition. They affirm that, but not as a way to Christians to relate to non-Christians on these issues. They went the other way. What do people of goodwill, can they share in common for judging nuclear policy? And on the basis of the violation of nuclear arms, of essentially two of the criteria of the just war tradition, they took a stand against any contemplation of first use of nuclear arms, any contemplation, any thought that you could wage a limited nuclear war. However, their judgment there was that it couldn't be. The nuclear war, it tends to escalate, and you probably can't carry out a limited nuclear war, and they rejected a policy of what's called counterforce. Counterforce is when you target military targets with nuclear weapons rather than destruction that comes about by targeting cities and civilian populations. And the Reagan administration said, you didn't understand this. Our policy is a counterforce policy where you only target military installations. And the bishop said, listen, we listen to the folks on the factual matters. There isn't any way of destroying those military targets without mass destruction of the civilian population. And it happens to be factually true. You can say the Russians were very devious. They put their military installations near civilian centers. Well, that violated two criteria of the just war tradition, namely the criterion of discrimination. You cannot, on purpose, destroy non-combatants, elderly, children, hospitalized, etc. And it violated the criterion of proportionality. Any waging of war can only be done in a morally legitimate way if you can have reasonable grounds to believe that more good will come than destruction will have occurred. You have to be able to say the outcome is such that we will be better off than if this war had not been waged. They could not conceive of nuclear war being one in which greater good would be the outcome than if it had not been waged. So, to relate this to faith and public policy, and then to end these few remarks, the Roman Catholics have in effect said, through the bishops anyway, there is a place for the radical witness of a community and of individual Christians who simply say no and they do it at whatever the cost, and they do it by nonviolent means. There is another way in which Christian faith can be related to public policy and nuclear arms, and that is to find common ground morality. It will not be the rigorous morality of those who are willing to put their lives on the line. Rather, it will appeal, actually, to how do we preserve who we are, and it will cross lines of faith. You do not have to agree with me in terms of whether you confess the same Lord or whether you believe in God or not to agree with me that on the common sense criteria of the just war tradition. On the latter, the Roman Catholic bishops took the latter tack and said that nuclear arms and our present policy does not measure up. Those are both faithful responses. They are quite different responses, and that's why pacifists have always argued with just war Christians. I just cite one sentence, two sentences, as a concluding statement here. Referring to these two traditions, both find their roots in the Christian theological tradition. Each contributes to the full moral vision we need in pursuit of a human peace. We believe the two perspectives support and complement one another, each preserving the other from distortion. The just war tradition tends to see the pacifist as forsaking the responsibility to care for all of creation, and the pacifists tend to criticize the just war people for relativizing or watering down the rigorous Christian ethic that is represented in the way of Jesus of Nazareth. And the Roman Catholic bishop says, tend to see these two, even though there's tension between them, as complementing one another. And I do think it is significant that on nuclear arms issues, you have a place where the pacifists and the non-pacifists do agree, coming out of those two traditions in their opposition.
Hands.
How would either of you argue the argument of William Buckley, who is a very, very, very loyal Catholic, who called these the war bishops?
In a way, we have a battle of language going out there, and the New Testament witness is very sensitive to the battle of language when it calls the devil the father of lies. And I know we need to be careful with that, but also need to be sensitive about the way words are used.
This doesn't address the issue. I know you're just using your fingers. You probably have to stop us by using your mouth. I don't think your fingers are...
Shut up.
Jonathan Schellen's book, The Fate of the Earth, talks about the kind of the craziness of deterrence, or using nuclear weapons as deterrence. But how do you handle the question that always comes about the fact that we must have nuclear arms to remain strong in order to deter the Russians? You know what I mean? I mean, that you get that stuff all the time. And I think it would be helpful to get some kind of help in those kinds of areas.
Is the vigorous hand back here? Because you want to respond to that?
I'd like to respond to that.
Please.
It also has to do with responding to Buckley. The only answer I can give to that is from what I know about preparations for war, the state that we're in now, that war is getting more and more likely by continuing down the path that we're doing. That, okay, maybe war is going to be likely if we appear to be weak. But I am convinced that war is at least that likely if we continue to appear strong. And that's based on, I've spent quite a bit of time reading and studying different levels of awareness on this. And I just say, let's try something different. What we're doing isn't working. That's my basic feeling, is that the that we're aiming toward war now, and that almost anything can be better than that.
If I can just report on the Roman Catholic bishops, they condemn deterrence in its present form and as an ongoing public policy, ongoing strategy. They give a qualified place to deterrence if it's where you're starting from in a procedure to step down, to reduce. If it's where you're starting from, but the direction is disarmament, arms control and disarmament. But they go on to then talk about alternatives to deterrence in the pastoral letter. And if you want to start with a military strategy, it is to talk about various forms of conventional warfare as forms of deterrence. And they actually give a place to increase conventional forces in Europe as effective deterrence for what they perceive to be
war and the instruments of war. And it seems to me that we ought to, at least in our own minds, keep these things separate. I work with the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory. I'm not involved in weapons work, but I do work for the laboratory. And I know many people who are very deeply involved in it. To a man or a woman, and there are women working there also, they are convinced that what they are doing is buying time. They pray that weapons will never be used, but they believe that they are buying time. Recently, Livermore was in the news with a demonstration. Our son was one of the demonstrators. He had breakfast at our house before he went. We asked on the way, and good relationship there. But it seems to me that there is virtually complete unanimity on the goals. The means are in dispute, and I personally see the bishop's statement and the demonstrations as a very positive action to begin the political process by which solutions will be arrived at. Solution will not be arrived technically. A new round of weapons, amicus, won't solve anything. The best it can do is provide time.
Dan, please, in
it. Just, it might be helpful to qualify when we say deterrence has worked. We're talking about the Northern Hemisphere, basically. Since the Second World War, 10,700,000 soldiers have died in wars in non-NATO or Warsaw Pact. Also, you have to raise the question, too, when we say it has worked or is working, you have to raise the question of all of the people that are dying of starvation, which is partly connected to our commitment to world armaments. So.
Would you please end it here?
Yeah, I guess I would still question the argument that it hasn't worked.
I'm sorry, could you say it again, please?
I would still question the argument that it hasn't worked, in the last, 40 years. Again, there hasn't been a major, what we would consider a major conflict between the major powers, and certainly no nuclear weapons have been used. Then Dan brings up the point about all those that have died, and I think this is the significant part, that whether it's the report by the bishops or the demonstrations or the arguments that we have, that we tend to say, no nuclear, but it almost sounds as if we're condoning the use of conventional weapons and, saying, well, the 10,000 don't count because they were killed with conventional weapons. We'll allow them to die. They probably didn't hurt as much as if nuclear weapons would have been used. And I think this is where some of the arguments tend to break down. What about the conventional wars and conventional weapons? Why condone those and just get rid of the nuclear? Why are we preoccupied with it? Isn't war war? Whether I die, as a result of nuclear weapons or as a result of conventional weapons, I'm dead. And I might suffer just as much with a firebomb or with a nuclear weapon.
Cliff, do you want to respond to that? You're the next hand.
Mine was completely different to that.
Can I bracket you then? Is there anybody who wants to directly respond to this issue?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to go non-speakers first. One, two, three.
It's the magnitude that's important. A nuclear attack will not just get the place where the missile falls. It's going to get people 500,000-700,000 miles away. It'll get Chicago, Cincinnati, Cleveland, New York City. It'll get to all the Russian cities. It's the magnitude. We can exist. We can exist in conventional warfare. The nations can still exist. But on an all-out nuclear attack, the magnitude is so great that we may not exist as nations. So.
Still doesn't make either one right.
No, it doesn't. No.
Okay, please.
Same point, except that we're not only talking about Cincinnati and Orlando, Florida, and Seattle, but we're talking Australia, Chile. We're talking about the whole world. Should two superpowers fight it out?
Okay, please hear.
My point, I guess, is related to all this, is that two superpowers are fighting it out. When we say that deterrence has worked, I really disagree with that. We have been fighting Northern Hemisphere battles in the Southern Hemisphere ever since World War II. My geography isn't all that clear. The North has been fighting in the South, essentially, since World War II, because we're scared to use our useless nuclear weapons. Our nuclear weapons really are useless to us since we can't use them. Therefore, we're using conventional weapons in countries that we can use as playthings. The other thing, I agree with you, Warner, that of course it isn't right. Conventional is no more a way to kill people than nuclearly. But there is a difference with nuclear, and that is that, using some of Dan's terminology, the reality of the principalities and powers has become absolutely obvious. That's what's different, is everybody's looking. There's been war, there's always been war. But now here's this brand new, amazingly horrible kind of war. And a whole lot of people who up to now have said, well, you know, a little war, it's kind of necessary and it's normal, we've always had it, are saying, this is what war is. This is what the best war makers can come up with. This is the net result, all added up, of every war ever that there's been. Now we see what war is. And that's why, people are jumping in and saying, let's get rid of nuclear weapons. But what I've seen happening is there's this huge coalition, this broad coalition of all kinds of people who start out either from a moral viewpoint or from a viewpoint of fear. They're scared of the destruction of this country or of all of humanity or of the whole planet. But almost all tend to work in a direction. Once they get scared and active, then the reality of peace and love and joy as an alternative, you have to have an alternative, starts showing up more. So I find hope in the existence of the nuclear weapons, that's like it's just goosing us and saying, you've got to notice, you just have to notice now. So there is a difference between nuclear and conventional, and it may be that difference that's going to make us realize that both are really wrong.
Warner, did you want to get a responding word in on that? Not to go into the room.
You know, I'm against nuclear weapons, but it seems to me that some of the logic that's used in it just isn't there. Like, you know, from a standpoint that you say that nuclear arms aren't a deterrent. Well, you can't say that they're not, because there haven't been nuclear arms used since the first one. So therefore, from that standpoint, the wars have continued, sure. And that makes me mad. But there hasn't been another nuclear bomb dropped. And that makes me happy.
I would like to make the point that wouldn't it have been better for this world, maybe if we talk in numbers of population, if approximately, 30 years ago we've been in the nuclear age, 40 years now, something like that, if 30 years ago the U.S. and the Soviet Union, before they had these huge world-destroying arsenals, had blown each other up and left the rest of the world alone. I mean, I see very clearly that we have been fighting wars on other people's property, and for the world in general, it would have been better if we had blown each other up way back when, before we had as much power as we do.
I can't see how you can make that statement knowing what you're fighting against.
Okay,
I mean,
right. Okay.
Well, I mean, it's almost like we can use that argument, but life is precious. I don't want the Russians to blow themselves up or ourselves.
But I don't want us to blow up ourselves.
Can I, I want to keep this in the community's dialogue, and I'm just going back and forth. June, are you directly in this? Don't lead us another track. We got other people who have priorities there.
Well, I think I may be in a little different direction. But don't leave me out.
Larry, please.
I just want to clarify a term. When we talk about whether deterrence has succeeded or not, strictly speaking, the word deterrence refers only to the presence of nuclear weapons being necessary to deter the use of nuclear weapons. But deterrence is not a word that refers to deterring war in general or fighting starvation or something else. Deterrence, as a policy word, refers only to the use of nuclear weapons and as a strategy that the presence of those nuclear weapons prevents their use.
Okay, now, you were up a long time ago, Dan.
Yeah,
is this conversation?
Comment, yeah, and Werner just suggests that there is a profound difference in kind between nuclear weapons and what we call conventional weapons. And then he gets the profound argument, the very persuasive argument of Jonathan Schell's book, The Fate of the Earth, because there's a real possibility to destroy not only humankind, but not only civilization, but the Earth itself in any real sense. And I think there's a failure of many of our leaders, particularly those who work for civil defense, to realize this when they talk about rising again from the ashes and sort of going on life, and the mail will be delivered after the attack, and there'll be sort of government and social system. And I think it's important to note tremendous destructive
effect. It's yours.
Okay, I wanted to talk what Larry was talking about there, about the deterrence, and what frightens me, you know, aside from the moral thing, because I'm afraid if I really followed that, I'd have to be a pacifist, you know. really followed it. But from the deterrence, and what frightens me is that we've really, the way that I understand it, we've moved from deterrence to first strike.
Yes.
And that's what the difference. You know, that is a whole different ballgame. We could deter the Russians probably with 50 bombs. You know, that's enough to deter them. That's enough to destroy the whole country. But whenever you're talking about first strike, we're going to get them before they get us. And, you know, that's a hair trigger. And that's what frightens me. You know, that is really idolatry whenever you're wanting to do that. You
want to
be a big dog.
Any first speakers on this issue? This issue?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Just a question. You know, the government certainly has never admitted. They've never said that they aren't going to use first strike.
That's right.
But they haven't said that they are either. So it's strictly been your assumption and the news media assumption that first strike would be the policy of the country. Now, a lot of people use the issue that because of the accuracy of the new missiles, such as Trident and some of those, that indicates that America is out after first strike. And I say, that doesn't have anything to do with it. The rockets we sent to the moon are more accurate than the ones that the Germans used in the V-2. So, I mean, technology advances accuracy, but that doesn't necessarily mean first strike assumption, it might be. But I'm just saying, don't say that unless, don't blame the government for something that they may or may not, intend to do. Let's be at least honest with our arguments against nuclear arms.
This issue.
In the southwestern Minnesota district of ALC last fall at our theological conference, the outgoing head of the chaplaincy for our armed services, either Nelson or Hansen, he's a...
Herman Johnson.
Johnson. Had to be one of those.
Right. But he's not outgoing. He resigned in protest against the Reagan administration policy.
And his protest was over that exact issue that he told our pastors, in that what disturbed him more than anything else was the fact that the mood had shifted to first strike.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Can I interject here?
The speculation about first strike doesn't, it roots in part about some people's suspicions of other people. If you don't like some of the people making policy in the Reagan administration. frustration. But much of the worry about first strike comes from the nature of the missiles. It's not the accuracy per se, Werner. It's that the kind of missiles like an MX can't defend against anything. They're not defensive missiles. They are only, if either you have to say they're a second strike to, in retaliation, to blow up the Soviets, in which case we've already suffered, presumably, a disabling, that's Pentagon talk, the mild term, a disabling first strike, and then we're sending them over so that we retaliate. Or else that kind of weapon is to prevent the Russians' first strike, in which case we got to be there before they let go any of their SS-20. So it's the kind of missile that gives rise to suspicion. It can't be used simply defensively unless you're talking about utter retaliation and massively destructive.
Which missiles do we have that are defensive? I mean, you said the question behind what you're saying is presumably we have missiles that are defensive.
Anti-ballistic.
Any missile could be first strike or second strike capability.
Yeah. Well.
Any missile could be.
Okay. Can I say something? I've already had. Okay. I think the difference is in the timing of these missiles. You know, with some of them you can send over there and they've got 40 minutes in order to retaliate. With some of these, they don't have that time.
No, that's the Persian.
You know, and you don't have that time to make any miscalculations. And it's first strike, hit them before they can get theirs off. And that's what worries the Russians about the MX.
And the Pershing, too, is in the
And the Pershing, and some of the others, yeah.
Shrinks the time from 30 minutes to about 8 minutes.
Or a cruise missile, which goes in between mountains, so it isn't detected. Yeah. There'd be no reason to not detect something if it wasn't first strike.
Okay, I've got a sequence of first speakers that goes 1, 2, 3.
Okay,
Tim? Tim.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I have a hard time distinguishing between missiles like this. I see that, you know, first strike sounds worse than deterrence, but on the other hand, if I look at it from a very personal standpoint on what my personal posture is under deterrence or under first strike, I end up seeing very little difference. Under first strike, if I say I'm willing to support a first strike in my nation against, say, the Soviet Union, I'm saying, okay, I'm willing to blow up all my brothers and sisters in the Soviet Union. If I say, well, but I don't support a first strike, but I do support deterrence, I'm still saying I'm willing to blow up all my sisters and brothers in the Soviet Union.
Right.
And I don't want to do either one. And I'm not willing to put myself in that aggressive posture.
Yeah, I'd like to ask the speakers a question from a biblical point of view, and that is the argument that those who struggle for peace are really interrupting God's will. That if you read your Bible, Armageddon is inevitable, and the best prayer we have is, come Lord Jesus, as quick as you can. And that the best Christian response, I'm serious, I mean, this is very prevalent. The best Christian response is
no response. Hmm? Probably no response.
is to fervently pray that God intervene and that Christ will come again, and that for those of us who are active in the peace movement, that we are really warning the final revelation of God's power. Now, how do you respond to that argument?
Okay, direct question. You go second.
It's a common argument, especially the thought that God says that God will destroy the earth by fire, so maybe nuclear weapons is God's way, so if we are trying to stop it, we may be thwarting God's way of destroying the earth. there's different ways to move into that. One is that God destroying the earth by fire, to my knowledge, is only in one book of the Bible. Second Peter, the last book written, barely made it.
Gospel struck.
I mean, it reflects the second century thought. The overpowering biblical witness is the redemption of creation. The overpowering witness of the scripture, both Old Testament and New Testament, is God's creation moving to Shalom. The witness of Jesus Christ is the affirmation of life and the fulfilling of life. So I don't see it's latching onto one obscure passage and ignoring what is, I think, the primary biblical witness that Paul affirms when he says the whole creation is groaning, waiting for its redemption. I mean, there's nothing in there that would say that somehow it's all going to be destroyed. It'll be destroyed as much as I was destroyed in my baptism.
Dan, there is that other passage about the mountains falling on people and whatnot that people bring up to me also. That's the other one that I've heard.
Those are cataclysmic events that are part of apocalyptic literature. Show how all of nature. Again.
Do you want to answer the question, Larry?
My reply would be even less satisfactory than Dan's. I think that the biblical drama is one of a community of successive communities of faith wrestling with when they come into a new situation, wrestling with the question, what does it mean now to be the people of God when that which we've depended on can't be depended on anymore? So in the exile, they had to rethink their whole notion of what God was about, who they were about. They lost the land, they lost temple religion, they lost kingship. All the marks of their religion were gone. There are successive new ages in Scripture when the community of faith has to ask anew, what does it mean to be the faithful community of God, and even ask who is God in this setting. The apocalyptic literature arises in some of those crisis situations because it's the new age, old age conflict. We're in that kind of situation now. And I think the theological question that we haven't faced before and have to face now is a theological question that focuses on human power. We have never been in a situation where it was possible by our hands to extinguish life to such a degree that one can't even be sure there will be future generations. Some of the biblical material was forged in a time when people felt powerless before the awesome power of God, whether it was in the form of the floods that came or other acts of God, as the insurance company still calls them, or something else. We have now found ourselves with powers we don't know how to use for the common good, but they are possibly there. I mean, they are there in such magnitude that we're in a very different kind of relationship. That's an unsatisfactory answer to someone who comes and says, but it says right here. I point to what seems to be the biblical dynamic of wrestling anew with the new situation. And the apocalyptic is a part of that, but it's not a matter of prediction.
Cheers.
Two things. One on this last thing. If this is true, that it is coming of the end times, all of our efforts won't stop God anyway, so we can keep going, and if we can do something, we'll do it. If not, we'll just go. But back to First Strike, my fear of First Strike comes from not Russia and not us. It comes from a small country to maybe another small country, and then all of a sudden we're taking sides. And there's been a nuclear attack on one country, and Russia's going here, and we're going here. And it just keeps going. That's where my fear of First Strike comes. To a country that doesn't have a defensive And I don't know. I mean, I have a fear of that, and I don't know. I worry if we can take our arms down and brushes, but what do we do about the small countries?
Proliferation issue.
I keep hearing people talking about faith, and I'm surprised that it's never carried a little bit further than it has been. I haven't really spent as much time as I might thinking about the subject of nuclear war. I don't like to think about unpleasant things, but last week I attended the annual meeting, the Pacific Northwest Annual Conference of the Methodist Church. I'm a Methodist. Incidentally held in all places, Pacific Lutheran University. We kind of got to decide in what kind of an atmosphere I think we're going to live in. We've either got to have an atmosphere of despair, or we've got to have faith. If we choose despair, there's no future. If we choose the attitude of faith, we've got to have faith in the Almighty God, or we got to have faith in the nuclear bomb. We know that we're lost if we really have a nuclear bomb. That's no way out. We either got to forget about the bomb and have faith in God and man, or we got to submit ourselves to another line of despair, which is the bomb. And I've passed the point where I can have faith in the bomb as a deterrent protecting us. I just don't think it's going to do it. I have a hard time having faith that God's going to protect me too, but somehow that comes easier.
Please.
Okay, I also not only see an arms buildup on Earth, but also arms buildup in space as well. The Reagan administration, I read something about a high frontier proposal, which he plans to launch 432 satellites in space, particle beam and infrared sensing devices. Robert S. Cooper, now with the new recently formed Space Division, says that these satellites will be in a defensive role. And then they will also be global in nature, which can be more devastating than just nuclear arms on Earth. I don't know. It all seems like it's just a creature that is just growing.
I've got a first speaker here, and then I'll be back. One, two, go ahead.
If I may, I'd like to ask each of your speakers, assuming that they were president of the United States and had the power to do whatever, carry out whatever you want to do, what would you do in this situation now as we see it, as we see the world situation and that sort of thing now, and you have the power to carry out whatever you want to do, what would you do? Let us stop being critical of what other people are doing and let us propose something, or at least imagine what we'd like to do.
I would appoint Richard Burnett as my advisor. Did you read Restoring American Power in a Dangerous Decade?
It's a subtitle. Real Security.
Real Security.
What's he going to do? We still got these world powers to deal with. But how are we going to handle that?
Can I respond? I always come back to the bishop's letter and at least say that they have addressed your question, Dick, in the sense that the last section of the last two sections of the pastoral letter are sections which offer constructive proposals after they've rejected deterrence, except as a starting point for disarmament. So it isn't as if people wrestling with this from the standpoint of Christian faith haven't heard that question and offered something, and they're offering this for discussion in the hopes that it will become public policy. Then to answer the question directly, it's been, I think, extremely interesting to read of the latest history of arms policy. Thomas Powers and others, who now under the Freedom of Information Act have had access to documents which show that there was a contemplation during the John Kennedy administration of a first strike against the Soviets, when the Soviets had very few nuclear missiles of any magnitude. And Paul Nitze, who is now our negotiator in Geneva, was one of those who, in those discussions, who finally said, no, we can't take that kind of chance. We can destroy the Soviet Union, but they just needed one of those through, and we would pay too high a price. Okay, that means that a very small number of missiles is effective deterrence. All right. In light of that situation, incidentally, Ted Sorensen, assistant to Kennedy, when he found out about this coming from Pentagon and others, said, you folks are crazy, and it was squelched before it got to President Kennedy. He was just informed about it. So it wasn't ever close to actual policy. In light of that, then I think George Kennan's proposals are a good one. And Kennan is maybe our foremost diplomatic historian, and maybe with Avro Harriman, one of our finest students of the Soviets. Kennan's proposal is that we take not unilateral disarmament, but unilateral initiatives. And if just a few bombs will deter, as even our hawks, like Paul Nitze, discovered, then let's say that we will announce to the world that we will reduce our forces by, and Kennan suggests, 50%. All right, scale that back. The president says, to show that this is a serious peace effort, we will scale down our nuclear forces next year by 25%. Now that's an example of unilateral initiatives. That may not be enough for some folks, but I think it's a constructive proposal that leaves deterrence in place if you don't think you can get support publicly for something more radical in the way of disarmament, that is a dramatic move that would garner world opinion on your side. There's an example.
Right. Murray, what did the bishop say? There are two concrete proposals.
You have to give me some time.
Okay, you can get in when you find it. Carol?
It's interesting to hear what's in the bishop's letter, but I know that the other churches have also made statements and very specific proposals. Why don't we hear about it from our preachers in our churches? And how come there aren't committees being formed in every congregation to find ways of peace and conflict resolution? I'm just rereading the Lutheran Mandate again this afternoon, and they have very specific proposals, and they make all these promises of what the church is going to be providing us. And I suspect that 90% at least of the American Lutherans have not heard directly about it in their individual congregations. Why?
Okay. Are there any clergy here who would like to take up that question? Do you want to respond?
I had my adult Sunday school class study that, except that nobody wanted to come. I mean, you know, they don't want to deal with anything that hot.
Yeah. Let me address that. We have a very good friend who's won't name the location, but he is under tremendous fire simply because he had a study group on studying the question. Just studying the question. I'm saying that the congregations are where the problem is. It isn't the pastors or the church. It's we. It's us, the congregation.
Okay, I have a vigorous hand over here. I assume it's on this issue.
As an ALC pastor, we've done that in the Pacific Northwest, and we spent 8 weeks in the spring, an adult class on Sunday morning, and we had 70, 80 people there who were very interested. So I don't want to paint the thing as a bunch of hawkish ALC people up there. Some people were very concerned about that issue.
Can you share what happened to the South Dakota District Convention last year? There was a resolution before the district convention towards peacemaking, towards this sort of thing, but it was twisted around by the convention to come out as a support of the Reagan administration.
Yeah. This same issue.
Yeah.
Okay, we're still dealing with Carol's question of, you know, why has this word not been spread in the church when it's there? I'll take hands on that one. Okay.
I think in reality, one of the reasons sometimes pastors don't do certain things is because they don't feel there's a support base within their own district, frankly, coming out of the bishop's office. Whether it's nuclear arms or whether it's, as we were talking earlier today, Indian affairs or anything, anything that tends to be an explosive, emotional issue, very frankly, sometimes I think twice whether I really want to be prophetic. Because I might have to move, or I might have lost my whole ability to minister in terms of saving souls, quote unquote. And so those types of raw issues enter into the parsonage or parish house, let me tell you. I don't offer that as an excuse or a justification for lack of action, on the other hand. But by no means of our, for instance, take any issue you want, by no means are our pastors or our bishops united on it.
Well, how come the vote was something like 96% at the national convention level? Was it something somebody pulled over on people and they didn't know what they were voting on or something?
There's been more action in the churches on the peace issue than anything that has come along. The possible exception of civil rights, and I doubt it.
Well, how do you argue against it? I mean, it's like arguing against your mother. Nobody's against
you argue by side.
I mean, I wouldn't vote for war either. So I'll vote for a peace issue.
No, I don't. There's some of that, Warner, but some of it gets quite specific. Namely, much action on the nuclear freeze. Now that's a controversial matter.
With the goal being the elimination of nuclear weapons, that's what our statement says. And it says as a first step to stop, and as a second step to reduce, you know, all of the Kennan proposal.
Yeah.
And it calls on churches to worship, you know, incorporate peace efforts into worship, education, you know, all aspects. And it... says it should be all people, not just the experts and so forth, that should be involved in it. And, there's another, you know. But I don't think even the text of it has reached the people in the congregation. And that's what I'm concerned about. Do the pastors just get it in their monthly mailing and put it on the shelf because they got to prepare next Sunday's sermon? Oh, the other thing was to have specific peace Sundays. And our church is one of those that never has a specific Sunday for any particular cause. It's their excuse for not having a peace Sunday.
Okay, excuse me for one moment, please. I've got a real hard backlog of hands going up, particularly of first-time speakers, and I'm going to give them a chance. I've got Carol, and then here, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4 in that sequence of folks who haven't had a word in yet. I would like to go in that sequence and then just simply say at that point it will be several minutes after 10. So everybody can take 3 or 4 deep breaths. Anybody who wants to leave then can do so. You're certainly free and welcome to continue the conversation. Carol, please.
Okay. I think maybe pastors are so smart that they understand that the issue is not politics but economics. And if you raise the question of economics and the whole basis for the arms buildup, you're talking about jobs and people on congregations everywhere. I guess my question, Larry, was if there's anything in the bishop's statement at all about changing the economic structure. It's clear that after World War II, there was a deliberate plan that was, you know, devised by corporate power and political power to build the arms race as a way to keep the economy moving after World War II, and it's gone on a steady basis, with corporate power having tremendous influence. Half of the money going in R&D in this whole country goes into corporate research for the war machine, and I'm wondering whether there's anything there that specifically addresses that.
There are two sections on the section on the promotion of peace, proposals and policies, and that's a lengthy section, mostly on arms issues without addressing the economic dimensions of that. Thus, accelerated work for arms control, reduction, disarmament, treaties, relationships with nuclear and conventional forces, civil defense, etc. Then there is a section of proposals, shaping a peaceful world. Superpowers in a disordered world, interdependence from fact to policy, etc. And then there's some address of Catholics in different walks of life, including those at work in defense-related industries. So there's some aggressive there, but that's mostly their struggles with conscience and the pastoral response to be with them in that struggle. So there isn't much in here on the economic dimensions of nuclear policies. What I think is interesting, however, is that the Roman Catholic bishops, you think they're in hot water now, have just decided to take on the critique of the economic order as their next pastoral.
Oh, it's worthless to talk about this whole issue unless that dimension is a major dimension.
I was at, I'm on the board of the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, and I went at our annual meeting. The Roman Catholics, who are the majority in the corporation stockholders movement and disinvestment and so on, were critical of the bishop's letter because it never addressed, when it addressed Catholics in defense of the state, it never addressed Catholics as shareholders in corporations that were contracting for defense. The bishops have heard that. They'll take it on, but it's the next time around. They've postponed the starting time a little bit, but it's a two-year project.
This is just on a very small level an answer to the question why, you know, what's happening in the congregations and why. In my own congregation that I was a part of, I had a speaker come in who was credible, for one thing, and just a communication issue, I feel it is sometimes in the congregations. The person has to be an interesting speaker, too, and credible, and I don't know, I guess those would be probably my two most important things. Just that little, that can make all the difference, I found, in the congregation's attitude towards the issue.
At a first time over here.
In defense of ministers going back to the congregations, and I feel they should to some extent, but I think when these things are discussed in theory among fellow pacifist people that can easily stand up and espouse these theories, to go back and talk to the congregation who consists of World War II vets, Vietnam vets, and take a strong stand on it and say definitely we've got to give up nuclear war and weapons, no matter what the Russians are willing to do, whether they're going to keep them, and we just say, fine, we're getting rid of all of ours, I think is very difficult. I mean, it's about the same hot temperature as discussing homosexuality. And they don't want to touch it, and I feel sorry for their situation. The second point, getting back to what we were talking about before, I think the only way we can really approach it realistically, no matter what we try to conclude tonight, we can't just say, well, fine, we'll do away with the nuclear weapons. I think it has to be, we have to concentrate on approaching the politicians in terms of scaling down, going backwards rather than expanding, rather than just freezing, trying to scale down. Because getting to your point of if one can deter, you know, if one is all we need to deter, why so much overkill? Let's scale it down.
Okay. Related to that, as a seminary student, it bothers me quite a bit that the major worry is seminary's financial position, and you get more emotional or more concerned about that than you do with social justice issues. But when those things are approached, I find a lot of people doing it sort of in a roundabout way, like through the hunger issue, and it's kind of not being prophetic about it. And I guess I say I don't blame pastors, but I think in theological education there is. Where there needs to be a lot of things happening too, and we're just not there.
Okay, before we go on, I promised that I'd take a break, so I'm going to take four deep breaths myself. That's an invitation to anybody who wants to leave to leave. But you know, if you stay, we're going to continue the conversation until one of us wears out as both.